Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the program again, to the second night of our investigation, really, into the whole experience and notion of no self, of life beyond self, of self dropping away. And I received many, many, many emails from you and a lot of questions, and of course I responded to many, many. I can't respond to them all, of course, but an awful lot, and I really appreciate all the questions. It really informs me what all of you are going through, and the tremendous diversity of what people are experiencing in their spiritual lives and their relationship to this subject as well. And so I really like having that kind of way of being connected with you through your sharing of your experience, your sharing of your inquiry, your sharing of your questions. It's really, really important part of all this. And there are so many different directions, so many different ways we could, you know, approach this. But I wanna go back to a couple of really simple ideas, and then we'll kind of expand and move on to some of the other subject matter for the evening. You know, of course, the challenge of all of this for all of us, for me in trying to communicate it, for you in trying to understand what I'm communicating, and also find some of it in your own experiences, is that the words that we use to communicate, you know, they're partial, and yet we do communicate. We try to be as clear and precise as we can. And I think, although an intellectual understanding of things has great and profound limitations to it, also at least a kind of understanding of the trajectory of the landscape, you might say, of spiritual awakening, I think can be useful if it helps bring some clarity to something that's actually happening in the moment for you. Then it can be useful. You know, if you get too preoccupied with where you fit into this sort of model, this spectrum of awakening and how you're doing and all of that, then it can start to take you away from your experience. It takes you away from finding clarity about your own experience, and it takes you into, you know, a whole host of imagined futures. So I just want to put out a kind of caution to counter the mind's tendency to want to know, you know, exactly where it is at all times and how it fits in with what you're speaking about. Some amount of that can be useful, again, if it helps you to clarify your present experience and maybe what you intuit is coming down the line. Then it can be useful. But if it becomes sort of a really something that's too tightly held in your mind, where you're measuring yourself against it, then maybe not so useful. So put out that qualification. I want to come back to really the central idea that we're all working with here. Two of them, at least to begin with, are, and people are still writing me in, which I understand because these are not easy concepts to understand, which is the concept of self and ego. It's funny how we talk about these all the time, and they're talked about in spirituality and psychology. I think we use them in our day-to-day language fairly often. And yet, when we really get very specific about it, often it's kind of unclear what those are, especially when they relate to the experience of the falling away of self. And once again, I think to have a basic understanding, and of course, all understanding has to also be grounded in some experience. But if we have some understanding of these ideas, they help bring clarity to the whole subject, which is if we just, again, if we look at self, self is the unseen subject or witness of all experience and all perception, at least as long as self is there. Self is the unseen witness of all experience and all perception. This is really what self-consciousness is. This is what self-consciousness means. This is a definition of self-consciousness, is it's the unseen subject of all experiences and perceptions. So self in this sense is really the, we could say self is the I. You hear people talking about themselves when they'll say, well, I feel this or I feel that or my ego, and they'll start to describe their ego. The I, the depth of the I, is really what self is. It's kind of self-consciousness, self-consciousness surveying the field of perception and then commenting on it. So self is a subjective thing. It's kind of the ultimate subject. It's the unseen subject. You can't see what self is. Self can never be made into an object. Self is, in a simplistic sense, you could say self is the witness. Self is what watches your thoughts and notices your feelings. Self is which looks at your ego and can even talk about your ego. Even the way we language things like my ego, it in that kind of language, it shows that there is a distance, at least conceptually, between me and my ego. If I can talk about my ego, I'm talking about something that has some distance from me. Although, granted, most people don't feel like their ego is at any distance from themselves at all. When self becomes identified with ego, then it doesn't experience any distance. It doesn't experience itself to be the witness. It experiences itself, well, to be whatever it identifies with. So self is the unseen subject or witness of all experience and all perception. Simple, at least conceptually. Ego is really the me, right? Ego is me. And the me is really a psychological process, right? It's a psychological process. Thinking, feeling, memory, judgment, opinions, ideas, all of that that goes into the ego. Ego is the lower form of ego, lives in the realm of aversion and desire. I don't want that. I do want this. I like this. I don't like that. I'm trying to avoid certain parts of life or myself or other people, and I'm trying to find or experience other things. So aversion and desire, wanting and not wanting, are very intimate part of the ego structure, right? We could say, so ego is the me, and self is the I. I am watching me. Now, when the ego identification is deep and profound, then the I and the me are fused in experience. In other words, I am my ego. That's an egoic state of consciousness where there's egoic identity. Well, I am what I think. I am what I feel. I am what I imagine. I am my judgments. I am my opinions. I am, you know. And of course, then ego projects that onto the world, that things are what I say they are. People are my judgments of people. The world is what I think it is. What should happen is what should happen, like as if it has some basis in reality. So I think just to look at ego and self in these ways are really instructive. Now, I think most of you are quite familiar in many, many forms of spirituality. In fact, most forms of esoteric spirituality, one of the initial things that they try to accomplish, that they try to have you do, the initial instructions, are to begin to develop the sense of the witness. So instead of being completely identified with your thoughts or your feelings or your imaginings or whatever, you're taught various ways to watch them, to create, in a certain sense, a distance. Because this distance lessens the identification. If you're watching something, you're not quite as identified with it. Right? So spirituality, often the esoteric teachings will emphasize the watcher to a great extent, right? If you're meditating, just watch your feelings, watch your thoughts, watch all perceptions just go by like a river passing by, do you know? And you're taught to just be the witness. What you're really being taught is to disengage or disidentify with the ego and to engage self. Self is the witness. Self is your most subjective experience of yourself. Self is the I. I is the witness. It's in the structure of our language. I see this. I'm experiencing happiness. I'm experiencing joy. Remember this. So there's always I, which is really the witness, the subjective experiencer. And then we go on to describe what we witnessed, what we experienced, what we felt, what we thought, right? So generally, in the egoic state of consciousness, the self and ego are, at least experientially, they're collapsed. They are experienced to be one and the same thing. I am my ego. I am what I think. I am what I feel. All that. I am what I believe. In spirituality, they often try to, because this is formed from a deep understanding of the one's inner life, which is ego and self are actually two distinct, different things. Right? They're two distinct, different things. Self is the subjective, unseen witness. You can never see self, because it's always the subject. It's always the witness. You can't see the witness. You can only see what the witness witnesses. The self is the unseen subject or witness to all experience, and so it's trying. And so spirituality will try to emphasize that as a way to disengage from the lower nature, which is ego. Even many of the sort of direct teachings basically direct you towards self. They don't necessarily use that word, but that's actually what they're doing. When they say, you are not what you think, you're the awareness of your thoughts. You are not what you feel, you're the awareness of what you feel. You are not your body, you're the awareness of your body. And if and when there is one can practice all this, you know, but when there is a fundamental, spontaneous shift of identity, it's actually, to some extent, often when identity suddenly leaves the ego. This sort of trance is broken, and identity leaves ego, or me, and it naturally goes back to self, or witness, the unseen subject of all experience. The unseen subject of all experience is the witness, or is actually the witnessing, is awareness, is consciousness. That is the unseen witness of all experience. It's the unseen subject as well. Right? When your identity shifts from ego to self, it's extraordinarily liberating. It's very, very freeing. It's like waking up from a dream, because it literally is waking up from a dream, the dream of me, the dream of ego. And now you experience yourself to be, you experience what self is. As again, we usually don't call it self because, number one, that's not a very fancy word. So we like to say, I am consciousness, I am awareness, I am presence, I am emptiness, The unseen self has all these qualities. It's empty in the sense you can't see it, you can't grasp, but it's transparent. It's like the sky, because once again, you can't see it, you can't grasp it. It's kind of a sense of pure awareness or pure consciousness, pure in the sense that there's nothing to see. It is the seeing of things, not the things that are seen. And this is pure, pure self. And it's emphasized in almost every esoteric religion that there is as a means of disengaging from ego. To have awakening is to awaken from ego to self, possibly even beyond self, but that's, we'll get into that in a moment. Now, self being the ultimate subject, the unseen witness of your life, self has this extraordinarily dynamic capacity within itself. Self, as I said, as most of us know, self can identify with ego or identify with me or a thought or a belief or an opinion or something like that. And that makes one feel very separate, isolated, very small. So self can experience itself to be extraordinarily small, extraordinarily isolated, defended. However, self has this sort of extraordinary capacity. Self can also experience its own subjectivity, in other words, what I am, to be something almost infinitely vast. It can go from infinite small and contracted to infinite vast, infinitely vast and expanded. The height, the highest form of self-identification is I am all that exists. That is the highest form of self-identification. It's a kind of unity, as you'd say. It's an absolute unity where self experiences itself to be non-separate from everything in existence. That's the highest, that's really, as I was talking about last week, that is the experience of unity. In the experience of unity, of course, you don't have really any sense of self as we conventionally think about it. Because as I say, we conventionally think about self very much like we think about ego, which is very problematic when it comes to really understanding the deeper realms of spiritual experience. Because we conventionally think of self as ego, that causes all sorts of problems. And when we come into the most subjective experience of self, the most profound and liberating sense of self, what we do is we think that therefore is the highest reality. That's another mistake we make. We don't recognize that what we're really experiencing is self. We think we're experiencing something else, something completely transcendent of self. Well, it's completely transcendent of ego. When self is in its most exalted state, it has no limitations to its sense of being, to its sense of identity. Its identity is universal. And so in that sense, when self is fully expanded, it doesn't feel in any way isolated or separate or even different necessarily. And so it's very commonly mistaken for the no self experience, or really more accurately, the falling away of self. Because you don't experience limitations, borders, boundaries in the highest form of self-identity, it's almost often mistaken as the falling away of self. But all that experience is actually what is indicative of the falling away of ego. Falling away of ego is what allows you to experience all of what I'm talking about so far. As I said last week, falling away of ego can be temporary, momentary, for a moment, an hour, a day, a week, a month, or it can actually fall away. Or more accurately say, one can transcend ego or have it fall away. One can transcend self, or one can actually have self fall away. I think it's more useful to see all this on one continuum, a kind of continuous spectrum, rather than to see these as sort of totally individualized, distinct experiences or perceptions. So, when one moves into no self, whether it's a momentary experience of no self, which is a self-transcending self, or self actually falls away, when that begins to happen, what you're doing is you're losing any sense of subjectivity. Subjective self, the unseen self, is what you lose. So, all the definitions that go with it, whether it's an egoic identity, I'm an ego, I'm a me, or it's as the watcher, as the witness, the higher forms of self, the watcher or the witness or awareness, or even higher than that, which is when, because the watcher and the witness is still separate from what it's witnessing, right? I'm awareness, I am not all the stuff I'm witnessing. That's a higher level duality. It's very liberating if you've never experienced it. It's very fundamental and it's a very freeing experience. It's a kind of awakening in its own right. But it's not actually even the highest dimension of the experience of self. The highest dimension of the experience of self is when the distinction between the witness and the witnessed starts to fall away. Then the witness becomes truly universal. A moment of self-transcendence, or when self falls away, is when this experience that I'm talking about, when those experiences fall away with it, because those experiences are the experiences of self in its highest capacity, which is extraordinary. It's one of the leaps in thinking that's necessary to make when we use this word self, is we can't see the self as ego. Self is an extraordinary capacity that we all have and that we all experience. It's extraordinary. It's not delusional, necessarily, in the way that ego is. It's extraordinary. It's profound. It connects one with the divine. More than connects one with the divine. So, before I get into too much, because a lot of people did write in, they wanted to kind of have some sort of understanding. What is this no-self state, which is really not a state, but I don't really want to get lost in a lot of fancy semantics, so I just use the word state. What is this no-self state like? But one of the transitions to no-self, because again, this exists on a spectrum. It's not like you just walk in one door and close it behind you and you're in a different place. It exists on a spectrum. So you can be in a very expanded experience of self and also beginning to experience some of the elements of the falling away of self. You can be having this simultaneously because it all exists on a spectrum in a certain manner of speaking. Well, let's go back to, for a moment, ego. As you wake up from ego, ego is not just a thought. It's not just a belief. It's not just an opinion. It's not all these conceptual things we talk about it. It is all those, but it's not just those. Ego is also a kind of it's like, as I said, it's desire and aversion, which is a kind of energy, right? I want, I don't want. This is a kind of energy. This is what I call kind of personal will. And it's obvious to think of personal will as far as what one wants or what one doesn't want. But personal will is also kind of the basic energetic quality of motivation. Motivation for what? Motivation for everything. From getting out of bed in the morning to walking to the breakfast table to putting your clothes on to going to work to, you know, everything you do during the day, it's all needs a kind of motivation. When there's no motivation, the ego is powerless. It's like an appliance in your kitchen, electric appliance that you have unplugged from the wall. Do you know your appliance can't do anything without the electricity? Ego can't do anything without personal will and without the requirement of energy that it gets to animate ego. So as we go, as ego really begins to fall away, we start to experience this loss of personal will. Even if you transcend ego for a moment, what you've set in motion, whether you know it or not, you've set in motion the inextricable ebbing away of personal will. Even if you pierce through and transcend ego for a moment, even 1 second, you have begun the inextricable falling away of personal will. It's like you've now got, it's like if you have a very small pinprick in a tire, do you know? It is, from that point on, you are losing air. And I know a lot of you know what I'm talking about when you start to lose the personal will. This can be a particularly confusing part of spiritual awakening. I want to make a distinction at this point between the losing of personal will, the falling away of personal will, that begins in earnest when we transcend, and especially when ego falls away, the personal will starts to its demise has really begun. But I want to make a distinction between the loss of personal will and what I would call a wounded will. There's a great difference between the loss of personal will and a wounded. A wounded will is a dysfunctional will. It's a will that in some sense is hindered. It's been wounded, diminished, disempowered, there's lots of life experiences that can actually wound the will. So the will's still there, but it's wounded. It actually has a hard time really moving, really doing things, usually because of life circumstance, traumatic episodes in life, difficult times you go through. Lots of things that people go through can, in different ways, wound the will. So the will feels diminished, right? That's a whole other subject that I could go into, but it's not really part of our inquiry, strictly speaking. But I want to make a distinction that the loss of personal will is not the same as a wounded will. It can, if you're not really paying attention, it can look very similar, you know. But a wounded will is a will of, there's a despair to it, right? A wounded will has underlying a sense of despair, a kind of despondency, right? The loss of will it's not about despair, right? It's not about a wound. It's not about you experienced something or you just saw something that you suddenly made you despairing, right? Or maybe you've become afraid of life, so you're rejecting life. When you're rejecting life, you're rejecting will as well. You're functioning from a sort of wounded place. The loss of personal will that comes from insight, however, the mind can grab hold of it and turn it into a kind of despair, but It's not originating in despair. It's not originating in a kind of existential sense of meaninglessness. That's also a wounded will. The loss of personal will comes from a lack of identification with the object of the personal will, the one who's going to carry it out. So when you see, when you realize, when you wake up from your egoic identity, the energy of will stop flowing to that egoic identity. Self also has a kind of will. Self has a different will than ego. Ego is kind of obvious. I want, I don't want. You know, I have my motivations, what I want to happen. I want to be loved. I want to be approved of. I want more power. I want more money. Do you know what I mean? Or I don't want to experience that. I don't want to see that. I don't want to know that. That's all pretty obvious kinds of, that's all egoic personal will. But self also has a kind of will in and of itself. This self-will is a much higher form of will, relatively speaking. The will of self is really, it's the will towards God, really. That's the higher will of the self. Self has a will, has a motivation. But its motivations are much more around love without a reason. See, ego will love, but it wants something in return. Self, in the higher form of self, self will love without any desire for return because it's just it's a natural outflowing of self. So love, compassion, kind of altruism, these are kinds of wills too, the will to be loving, compassionate, and all that. And it's beautiful, and it's kind of radiant, and it's expansive, and it's you know, it's, as I often say, it's what everybody wants when they think of spiritual awakening or enlightenment. That's the stuff you can want, you know. You want all that kind of stuff. That's wantable. It's desirable. It's, you know, peace, freedom, love, compassion, radiance, the presence of God, you know, all that kind of stuff the desire for that comes from your higher self. As I say, the desire for it for its own sake, right? When there's no, you know, what will this get me necessarily? So self has some very, very beautiful and very pure motivations when you tap into it. And you, when your awakening is on that level, it's a very beautiful, in a certain sense, exalted, inspired state of being to exist in. It does have, on one sense, it's almost like if you think of a coin, on one side of the coin, because self is unseen and unseeable, it has no form. It's the ultimate subject. It's the unseen subject of all experience. It's also empty. So in one way of looking at it, it's completely empty. There's nothing there to it. There's no there, you know. But it's not a dead emptiness, that there's an alive quality to the emptiness. But in that emptiness, there's not, when you're in the emptiness of self, there's not the kind of motivation. There's not seeing things as problematic. There's not the sense that, you know, you have to go out and fix things yourself, somebody else, fix the world, all that kind of stuff. On the other side of this coin, I'm using this as a metaphor for self, there's the other side, which is not just emptiness, but it's a kind of radiance, a kind of beauty, a kind of boundless love and well-being, right? That which, even though it comes from self, it's a selfless kind of love. It's a love that's unself-concerned. It's unself-obsessed, you know? It reaches out and it It loves all things unconditionally. The reason it does it, because in its higher realization of self, self notices it and experiences itself to be the common thread within all beings. Right? Your unseen self and anybody else's unseen self is the same self. It has no history. It has no past to it. It has no form. It has no, it doesn't have those kind of defining characteristics. It's not male or female in the way your egoic identity can be. It's very, very pure. It's very, very profound. It's very, very beautiful. And it's universal. It sees itself in, eventually in its higher realization, when you get beyond just the witness, it sees itself as all things and all beings. And so that's its sort of motivation. Its boundless love and compassion and radiance is its the energy that drives it. That's why I say it's that which seeks God or truth, right, for its own sake. So strange as it seems, self has some very selfless qualities to it in its higher nature. Some very, very selfless qualities to it. It is what reaches out beyond, I guess you could say, whatever you call beyond, reality, God, the Godhead, whatever. It's very beautiful. So there's a kind of losing of the personal will that drops away when we either transcend or the ego drops away. Personal will starts to be diminished, the egoic personal will. That can be confusing enough. Like, what do I do? Where do I go? What's my motivation? What's my orientation in life now that it's not egoic? Do you know? And that can be confusing, and people can kind of stay in a limbo zone of not really knowing what moves them until they connect with a higher aspect of self, which is love. Why am I here? What am I supposed to do? What's supposed to motivate me? Love is. From self, its highest motivation is love. But often when one kind of self-will is falling away, the other more abundant kind of will or energy isn't readily apparent. It's like, it's almost like to come into the highest form or function or realization of self, the most universal realization of self, the ego really has to completely die. Right? So you can't have half of the egoic personal will die and experience all of self. It's so there's this dying out process. It would be nice if you just transitioned very quickly or immediately from one to the other. From self-centered will to boundless loving kind of will. Occasionally it happens that way, but it's relatively rare. But when it comes to self, now self is where all the good stuff is. The boundless, radiant heart, loving, compassionate being, a kind of sense of, there's a kind of inspired way of existing. It's a radiant energy. On the flip side, it's transparent, it's empty, it's without form. All of those together. Now imagine that all that's available to you, all that's part of your experience. It's a very wonderful, exalted, beautiful place. You could even call it, it's a very enlightened existence, if it's all come up to the highest, higher level. Now, when self starts to drop away in terms of personal will, this is almost like a universal will at the highest form of self. It's kind of a universal will. That starts to drop away too. That's what's most surprising. That's what's most disorienting. for some people who are who have really they've really grasped onto that, it can be disappointing, difficult when that all starts to fall away. Egoic personal will, a lot of that's really nice when it falls away. Feels good. Might be disorienting for a while, but it essentially feels good, liberating, freeing. When self-will falls away, it's like the good stuff's fallen away, right? The benefits of one's spiritual realization. Again, what we're beginning to lose then is the unseen self. The unseen self that we see in all things, the unseen self that's sort of the unseen witness, the absolute subject of all experience, and that falls away. There's a kind of will that's lost with that too. That kind of will is cuts more to the bone. That loss is more fundamental even than the egoic personal will. That's a much more it's a fundamental energy source. It's a motivation force. As I say, the higher forms of self-realization are exalted, you could say, are radiant. And that's a kind of energy. It's a kind of motivation. It moves you. And to have that, when self starts to fall away, that kind of energy starts to fall away with it. And that can be very odd, very strange. And when people start to experience that, again, very rarely does this happen like that. Very rarely is it all one or all the other. The trajectory goes in that direction. But, you know, it's like, it's kind of like, you know, when you grow up, you don't just go from infancy to childhood or from childhood to adolescence or to adult. You know, it exists sort of on a spectrum. And I'm very well aware that in non-dual teachings, you know, we're talking about the highest reality being off this sort of spectrum, off the whole wheel of becoming. And that's true, and that's true experientially, it's true in an abstract sense as well. But I think when you just leave it at that, it doesn't really suffice. It doesn't talk completely to what people experience. It's often, those kind of statements are often the statements of a peak moment of realization. I'm not talking about a peak moment of realization, because those are much more easily defined, easily talked about, you know, easily shared, a peak moment. I'm talking about the day to day to day to day, where the peak moment will at some point become your day-to-day reality. But as I say, very few people, although you can go there immediately, instantly, very you kind of go there, and then you also are simultaneously evolving on this sort of spectrum that I'm talking about. So the loss of self-will is the loss of this very exalted kind of energy. Motivation. It's literally kind of, when it starts to drop away, it feels almost like the base fundamental energy of your physical existence. This isn't the same as being ill or being sick or things like that. It's something much more existentially rooted. Because up until the falling away of self, there are reasons. As I said, in ego, we all know the reasons ego does what ego does. It varies from person to person, but I don't think they're hard to find. In the highest form, higher forms of self-realization, the motivations, the reason to do are to express the radiance of being, to express the boundless love of unity, the fact and the experience of unity. When self falls away, however, those start to diminish. And the transition, what people have a very difficult time with often, is you're actually in the transition, not in the end point, but in the transition, you're having to function, to move throughout life without any kind of energy that could be called in any way motivation. Even if it's the most lovely motivation of unity consciousness. That's the dilemma that people, how do I move throughout the day when not only is the egoic motivation, but the sort of existential motivation of the self, unified self, is no longer present or is diminishing. What do I draw upon? And in the transition, what you start to realize is you have to stop trying to draw upon any resource of energy or motivation. That's what's falling away. That's what you have to be able to start giving up. That doesn't mean that you stop doing things. That's the key. What's called for isn't here now just to disappear in a cave for 10 years, necessarily. Even if you do disappear in a cave for 10 years and you don't have to do anything, number one, you'll come out of the cave eventually. And number two, while you're in the cave, it really won't show you how to make this transition. It's, you know, people often get stuck here because they don't really let go. They're concerned about where it's all leading. They want to re-grasp at the beautiful, exalted, radiant experience of being. They, you know, a lot of different reasons people will grasp and then stall out, sort of. But it has a usefulness if you, it actually is a good thing if you have certain base things that you have to do. It's actually good if you have a job or you're raising children or you have to do things, whether you find this base fundamental existential kind of motivation or not. You start to realize, at first it can be quite confusing and disorienting, but you start to realize that you don't need that to function, that you can function anyway. You can actually do it anyway. And this is a kind of weaning. In that phase, we're literally being kind of weaned away from all forms of personal will. We're being weaned off of them. Even the higher, more beautiful forms of will. And we're realizing that we can actually function, move throughout the day in the complete absence of them. And as we really embrace that, we don't just retreat and put our heads under the pillows and go, oh, I can't find any energy or will or motivation to do anything. That doesn't work. That's a kind of resistance. That's a lack of trust. But when you go through this transition, you realize you don't need to draw on that kind of energy, even the exalted energy. And eventually, who knows what eventually means? It's different in different cases. But eventually, self completely falls away, the subjective experience completely falls away. Not just for a moment, but it falls away. It's gone. And when it completely falls away, then we're, at that moment, we stop experiencing life through any medium. What I mean by medium is, in the egoic state of consciousness, we are experiencing ourselves, other people, the events of our lives, through the medium of an ego. Everything relates to the ego. When we're in self, we're experiencing life through the medium of self. It's a beautiful medium, but we're experiencing life through the medium. We're experiencing ourself, we're experiencing whatever's left of self. We're experiencing God, we're experiencing life through the medium of self. We think that we're not because it's so exalted in that place. It's so beautiful. It's expanded. It's loving. There's a joyous to it. There's a kind of liberation to it that we think we're experiencing everything without any medium. We would probably even deeply resist the very idea that we are experiencing life through any kind of medium because it's so wonderful. But of course, we only realize that we were experiencing life through the medium when that medium falls away, meaning self falls away. Then we realize, oh, I was experiencing life, I was experiencing God, I was experiencing what I am through the medium of self. When that medium is no longer there, there's nothing between. Then there's just the infinite experiencing itself from within itself. In other words, it's sort of, if we put it in theistic sense, it would be, it's no longer you experiencing God, but it's God experiencing God. It's a very great difference between when the ego's experiencing God, when self's experiencing God, it's very beautiful, very lovely. And when God is experiencing God, or God is, or whatever you want to make of what you are. I mean, it's a dangerous thing to say, to equate yourself with God. You know, it's prone to all sorts of egoic nonsense. But it's experiencing God, experiencing life from life's point of view. Experiencing the divine as the divine experiences the divine, which we thought we were doing often when we were in the totally expanded self state. We thought we were, but we only find out when it falls away that actually it was through, even that was through a kind of medium. When we're experiencing the divine from the divine's point of view or from within the divine, it's a very, very different experience. The problem with communicating that is it can't be defined by language, because language exists only in duality. Like, you know, radiance is only a relevant idea in terms of its opposites. Being happy can only exist in terms of its opposite, sadness. And so it goes. And so all these ways that we use to describe are relevant to their opposites. But when there is no opposite to what you're experiencing or what is being experienced, there is no opposite to it. Someone would say, is it love? You go, no, it's not love. Well, is it not love? Well, no, it's not love. You see, it's not other than love, but it's also not love, because love also has a corollary opposite. Is it radiance? No. It's not radiance, because radiance has a corollary op. Is it expansion? No. It's not a sense of being expanded at all. It's not a sense of being contracted at all. If you took expansion and contraction, because those can only help happen to self. Self is the only thing, and ego is the only thing that can expand and contract. Self-consciousness, that's why I said self-consciousness is extraordinarily dynamic. Expand, contract, and turn into happiness, it can turn into sadness, it can turn into selfishness, it can turn into saintliness. All exists on the same spectrum. And of course, I think a lot of people that are probably listening have had certain kinds of expanded, exalted kind of experiences. But when self drops away, it's not There's no expansion. There's not a contraction. There's no inside. There's no outside. There's no subject to which things are happening. And I'm talking about not as a philosophy, but as an experience. The experience is no longer life, is something that's happening to me, whatever the me is, whether it's an ego me or an expanded me or anything else, that the subject is not there anymore. The unseen subject is no longer there. When the unseen subject is no longer there, the objective world of things out here and around us disappears as well. It's a package deal. Can't have one without the other. So you can see it's easy to talk about everything except the fundamental reality. Everything right up to the fundamental reality, what I sometimes call the infinite, you can talk about. You can describe it. You can contrast and compare and do all these things. But when it comes to the infinite experience from the infinite's point of view, all of a sudden, all of that just comes to a complete halt. It comes to a complete stop. And that's why it often sounds, because it can't be talked about very much, it can sound to be negative, but it's not negative at all. It's not negative, it's not positive, it's beyond that. We don't have a word in our language for what's beyond that. Beyond also means other than all of that. Ironically, it's extraordinarily simple. It's extraordinarily undramatic. Now, when I say the subject completely falls away, again, when the subject totally expands to become everything, it feels like it's fallen away because you don't experience the edges to it. But that's an infinitely expanded subject. Infinitely expanded I am. But when that infinitely expanded I am falls away, again, on a day-to-day experience, experientially, life isn't happening to you in any way. As I say, it's like life experiencing itself from its point of view. Life doesn't happen to itself. I mean, we can say that to try to make something more clear, but really it's sort of redundant. It's a contradiction. I think it's more clearly talk about it, as I said, almost in its what it's not, you know, it's not subjectivity. So, and only when that subject falls away do you realize, you experience that almost everything up to that point had to do with a kind of subjectivity, you know? Subject. Will the subject be happy? Will the subject ever awaken? Will the subject find God? Will the subject be enlightened? Will the subject, you know, ever stop being bothered by his or her thoughts? Will the subject achieve liberation? Well, all the ways of the, it's everything revolves around the subject, including when the subject goes, you know, universal. It's the universal I am. Now, I know this is another dense evening, dense in the sense of kind of, you know, there's a lot here, but it's not going to slow me down. It's a very, very quiet, very undramatic state to you know, because there's nothing to be divided inside. There's not a psychological division. You can't be divided against yourself, unless you have a self who is divided against something else, right? So if the self's not there and the ego's not there, it's there's no way to be divided. The thing that's come up to me over and over is, as a precaution, is that, you know, the ideas, I mean, if I went back 30 years ago and someone talked to me and I heard something or read something about falling away of ego, falling away of self, I would almost only be able to think of that in some very, very sort of lofty, almost otherworldly way. And even if I tried not to, I imagine that I would have projected unconsciously and unconsciously of a whole kind of idea about what that would be like or what such a person would be like. And the irony of it is, it's more like you just become like any other force in nature, a cloud, a tree, a leaf, the wind blowing through the leaves, a rock, for God's sake. Do you know, all these things are just what they are. None of them are saintly or holy or this or that or unsaintly or unholy or, do you know, even the objects of life, we could say life around one, they are just what they are. They're not in conflict with themselves. They're not in division. They're not struggling against themselves. Do you know, the trees aren't arguing with you. They're certainly not arguing with themselves. There's a profound simplicity to it. And I'm not saying we just equate ourselves simply with the objects in nature, but I'm just using them as sort of an example, kind of a metaphor, that this doesn't mean an extraordinary person necessarily. If you want an extraordinary person, stay in the state of self. High, high state of high self-realization, exalted, radiant, and all of the good stuff. That's where you can be, you know, you find your saints and your holy people. That's where all that is. No self, it's not that. It's not that. It's, in a certain sense, and I'm not saying one is better or the other or any of that kind of nonsense, but I'm saying in a certain sense it's beyond that. But what's beyond all that is a profound kind of simplicity, almost a kind of ordinariness. But it's an ordinariness that once you've bumped into it, you would never exchange it for all of the wonderful, radiant, lovely spiritual experiences and identities that you've ever had in your whole life. You would never even think of changing it in. It would just seem completely, it would never occur to you. That's why I say it's hard to explain this in really positive terms, because it's beyond positive and it's beyond, you know, freedom and being bound. It's beyond all that. All of those things are literally created by self. Boundedness and freedom. Illusion and truth. Contraction. Expansion. All of that is our experiences that self has. That's why I say self is extraordinarily impressive in its capacity to have a vast variety of experiences of itself. It's almost unimaginable. It's one of the infinite's most amazing manifestations. That's why you can't, like, I think you will not hear me during this course making a pitch for no self, as if to say, hey, you know, realize no self because it'll get you more. There's something better in it for you. That's not what does it. That's not what gets you there. The thing that really, I mean, anything can get you there, even a mistake can just happen out of the blue sometimes. But for most people, the thing that really is a really vital component is, do we want the truth for the sake of truth, or do we want the truth for a payoff? So we feel wonderful or radiant or exalted or lovely or we're powerful or whatever. Do we want it in the end of the day for a payoff? Or do we want it for its own sake, no matter what it is, no matter what? If we talked in theistic terms, do I want God for what God can do for me or for what God actually is? Do I desire God in order to have my experience of God? Is that what? Or do I desire God to be God no matter what God is? If God transcends all of my experiences, now do I still want it? You see, so there's this kind of unrestricted desire for reality on its own terms, for what it actually is, no matter what it ends up to be. This is one of the most powerful forces that drives this whole thing along. And it originates, that kind of intention, in a place beyond self. Of course, this doesn't mean that you never experience, that you're unloving or don't experience love or don't experience compassion or you don't experience, it doesn't necessarily hinder what is experienced. It's just that that is not where your fundamental reality is. You're not moved by those things. I remember very distinctly in the first probably 5-6 years of my teaching, I kind of existed in, looking back on it, what I would call kind of an exalted state all the time. I was in this extraordinarily inspired state of being, whether I was spiritual, whether I was teaching or driving my car down the freeway or walking through the grocery store. I mean, there literally wasn't a second in a day that I didn't feel really sort of just taken up by this that I realized myself to be, that was just taken up into it. There was a kind of very exalted experience. I'm not saying that I was an exalted being. I'm saying the experience was very, very exalted, very inspired, very beautiful. Simultaneously, on the flip side, there was also a profound emptiness to it and quietness to it and simplicity to it. So it was this whole mix, but it was literally part of a very powerful part of experience 24 hours a day, every second of the day, every second of the day. I didn't have to try to maintain it. I didn't have to practice it. I didn't have to push it along. It had completely swept me up into itself, completely. It has had its own momentum. So you can imagine, after existing in that kind of place, extraordinary energy as well, existing in that kind of environment, when that environment started to fall away. I mean, it's almost like, you know, someone came up and just pops you with a pin and you start to, it all just starts to leak out of you, and you know, for some odd, strange reason that I really couldn't explain and still can't explain, I can't explain why I wasn't concerned about it at all, actually. Some people get very concerned about it. I wasn't concerned about it in the slightest bit. It didn't bother me. It actually, as it started to happen, there was a strange sense of relief to it, actually, in a way of to not live in that exalted state. It was kind of a relief, really. It was kind of, okay, you know. And things sort of came into such an extraordinary simplicity. And even the reasons for what I was doing completely changed, or I would say the reasons for what I was doing disappeared. And all of a sudden, there I would be, say, going out and talking to a group of people. And if somebody asked me, why are you doing this? If I was to be honest, and people did ask me, and I did try to be as honest as I could, I would say, do you know, I really don't know. What I mean by that is there wasn't a reason. There wasn't a compelling reason. There wasn't inspiring. I wasn't trying to save people. It wasn't inspired by radiant love. It wasn't inspired by compassion. Not that compassion wasn't there, that love wasn't there. It could show up as soon as I started to talk to somebody, to dialogue. But it wasn't the reason. It wasn't the compelling force. In other words, it was like the reason for doing it was just the doing of it. There was nothing behind it. There was no alternative driving force. It was like just life was just living itself. It just happened to be doing this. It was lovely, you know, as it still is to this day. It's wonderful. It's really beyond expression to see somebody, anybody, come into a truer, fuller, richer experience of the truth of their being. That does make the universe sing, you know. There's really nothing better than that. Even if it's just a small step for them, it doesn't matter how big or small it is to me at all. And yet something still moves, right? But it's not a inspiration necessarily. It's not a driving force of love. It's not the driving force of compassion. It's the source of all of that. You see, it's not other than that. It's not contrary to all of that. It's the source of all that. And the source of all of that cannot be defined by how it manifests. The source of it, you know, is different. So the source of it is kind of a extraordinary voidness, which, you know, probably for some people listening goes, God, that's awful. But the best way I can communicate with this degree of voidness is I actually call it, if you imagine an absolute infinite potentiality, absolute infinite potential. When I say the infinite, that's what I mean. I don't mean any particular experience of the infinite. I mean what's beyond the all experience, absolute infinite potential. Now, if you imagine absolute infinite potential, imagine that that potential has not become anything. It's not then just like an empty box, right? It's empty. It's completely void because it hasn't become anything, but it is still absolute and infinite potential. What some of the deep Christian mystics would call the Godhead, I call the infinite. And everything is that potential. So, you know, if someone said, well, what is the highest reality? You know, well, you could just take your shoe off and hold it in front of them and say, well, this is it. Because the shoe is as infinite, as much the concrete presence of the infinite as anything else, of any experience you've ever had, no matter how sublime, expanded, or anything. Nothing is more concretely the infinite than a stone you pick up off the ground. But to see, to know what that stone is the, if we can even talk in these relative senses, but is the beauty of the no-self state. To know what everything, everyone is. I call it sort of the substanceless substance of everything. It's not the essence. It's not a little piece of something. It's the isness of everything. The isness of everything is the infinite. And so, as this is really, really seen and really, really lived, the search for any experience is over with. Because if really, truly, not just conceptually, not just in theory or a momentary experience of insight, but if actually day-to-day lived moment-to-moment, if everything, every experience, everyone, everything you bump into and meet and experience is actually the infinite, well then, there's no, the great search is completely and absolutely undone. Unity is undone because things aren't even unified. There is only the substanceless substance. There's only the infinite. It can appear as a rock or as a sublime state of expansion. From the infinite's point of view, it doesn't matter at all. One's not more anything than another. It's just like it shows up as a rock here, it shows up as someone's experience there. When we're in any degree of self, well, we want that wonderful, extraordinary experience to some extent. We're still defining truth or self or God in some limited way. And if self, of course, self is what grasps at a change of experience when you're in some expanded state and then it changes to something different. The self in you is what tries to hold on to it, tries to reproduce it, laments the changing of experience from something that seems quite divine and profound to something much more ordinary. But when all self falls away, all of that is over with. That's why I say it's not a holy state. All the holy states, those belong to the highest dimension of self. The infinite never imagines, never conceives of holy anything. It never conceives of spirituality itself. There's so no separation in it that even the idea of no separation doesn't occur in it. So ironically, it ends up to be something profoundly simple, doesn't it? Profoundly simple. And if you took 1,000 people who all had not just a moment of transcending self or some part of the but if self really fallen away, if you took 1,000 of them, you would find 1,000 people that would be very different from each other. They wouldn't all agree on everything. They wouldn't have, you know, all like the same kind of ice cream. They wouldn't have the same way of, you know, the fundamental reality of their being would be the same. But apart from that, they would be very, very diverse people. Some might look quite spiritual and holy, might appear that way naturally. Others, you know, would appear completely unspiritual, absolutely. Some of them probably wouldn't even have the slightest interest in anything in spirituality. Why should they? Why would they? You see, so I think one of the greatest barriers that becomes to these deeper states of realization is the images that the mind holds of what it all will look like or should look like. Those are profound barriers. All those have to be let go of or simply cast aside. So we completely let go into the unknown. We have about a half an hour left. I'll open the phone line, so if anybody wants to call. And please, if you're going to call, if you want to call, please try to have your question. I really want to stay on this subject here, you know, because I understand that people can have all sorts of concerns and questions, all legitimate in their own right. But I really want to, for this course, we're really looking at this phenomena, this one phenomena. Of course, as you can tell, it spans this great spectrum of the human, of the spiritual experience or human experience. It's this, you know, we've taken this great journey, even if only conceptually, between last week and then tonight. But we're really exploring this particular subject. That's really what I want to focus on. That's really what I want to talk on. And of course, you know, I can't talk about all the particulars in a 2-hour talk, or if, you know, I could do this, we could do this together for a whole year, which might be a lot of fun. Who knows? We'll might do it sometime. But, you know, a lot of the particulars of the different ways people experience these things, their own sticking points, what they're dealing with, you know, these you find on the Q&A pages. I'm answering, you know, on a slow day I might answer 8 or 9. On a big day I'll answer 25 or 30. A lot, and there's a lot of the minutiae of different peoples of experience with all this comes out in those pages. So in the talks, I'm not necessarily trying to piece together every potential minutia in the sense of every way that different people might experience different pieces of their own unfolding. It would be nice if I could do so, but you know that it's just one. You know, one would talk literally forever, and you still couldn't speak to every single person's unique journey with all this, because although there are some parts of this that are have an underlying sameness when we really experience it. In other words, when we've transcended the ego, we have. And when we haven't, we haven't. When the ego's fallen away, it has. And when it hasn't, it hasn't. And the same thing to do with self. There are these fundamental points along the way that are universal. But each person's journey to that and they're coming into that, and the way that is uniquely experienced for them is going to be different from people. So each person undergoes a very, very unique journey, you could say, even if the journey ends up exactly where you began, in a sense. Each of us goes on our own very, very particular journey, and this is one of the things that I always try to encourage people is, yes, it's nice if you're open to a teaching, if you trust the teaching, you trust the teacher, it's nice to be open to that. But at the same time, you have to really be not always trying to conform your experience into, you know, what the teaching or how you understand the teaching. Or it's a subtle line here, isn't it, between trying to make use of something and trying to conform yourself into something, because then that limits the your own unique unfolding. And every person has their own very, very, very unique unfolding. And if you try to shove yourself too much in any particular box, you know, well, if that box just happens to be the way your unfolding goes, great, it all works for you. But if it doesn't, then, you know, it will be much more difficult. If you kind of open it up a little bit and allow yourself to have your own your own unique way with this, to let it unfold just the way it is, just the way it is unfolding for you. So I'm trying to kind of present the big strokes during these talks, and I get into much more of the minutia when I'm actually addressing people's questions, because that's where the minutia is relevant, you know. And yet I think when people hear other people talk about their experience, or when they read about it through Q&As and stuff like that, they start to realize that even the minutia is actually quite universal. You know, you start to be able to really identify with what many, many, many people are either going through or have gone through. It's one of the beautiful parts of having ways of sharing and giving voice to the great variety of ways that this unfolds, and the great variety of inquiry and questions and revelations that people have, because we start to see that although we have a very unique part of our journey, that even our uniqueness has a lot of universal qualities, a lot of universal qualities to it. So I think this is a really, really important part of the journey. But like I said, you know, we could just talk about this falling away of the personal will almost forever. I've already addressed many people's questions through their emails about this that we've posted. But, you know, people are having their experience of that falling away of that kind of will often very early in their spiritual lives. It doesn't just begin at some very advanced state. It starts actually very, very early. And, of course, what people bump up against is the will, you know. You're meditating and you want your meditation to go one way, but it's going a different way. Your personal will is confronting what is. And, you know, and you experience that battle between what I want and what is, and what I want and what is, and what I, and a big part of our spiritual unfolding is to see that those battles are never ultimately winnable. They're never really ultimately winnable. That it's not what is that is causing us so much suffering. It's our battle against what is that's causing all the suffering. I read this wonderful thing. I'll go to the phones in 1 second. I read this wonderful thing by Meister Eckhart. I've talked about him before, where he talks about, you know, someone knocking on the door of God, you know, and they're knocking and they're knocking and they're knocking and they really want the door to open, and they're knocking and they're knocking and it never opens. Why isn't the door not? So they keep knocking, you know. And then finally, they just kind of stop knocking, and when they stop knocking, the door opens. This is also universal. When you stop knocking, the door opens. When you stop struggling against, or even struggling to get something or attain, then the door opens. It's a paradox, isn't it? It opens when you're not trying to make it open. And as long as you're trying to make it open, it doesn't open. But if you just hear that and you go, well, then forget it. I won't do anything. And if it opens, it opens. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. That doesn't work either. You know, being a dropout doesn't necessarily work either. The difficulty of communicating what's really called for, you know, is a surrender, not dropping out. Dropping out doesn't work. That's a way of going unconscious, but surrendering, you know, get yourself to the door. Once you're at the door, don't keep trying to beat it down. Get yourself there. Anyway, let's see. I'm going to go to a phone call here to Tara from Germany. Hi, welcome.
Hello. Good morning, I have to say. It's 4:30 in the morning.
Well, bless your heart for staying up.
I slept a bit and got up.
Good. Well, I'm glad you called. What would you like to talk about?
Yeah, I am experiencing like a going up and down between very dense ego states, like down to kind of egoic thoughts about depression, suicide, lower, you know, also lower strong egoic kind of identifications.
Yeah.
And then very high states of being the infinite, having the witnessing, collapsing, and states of no self.
Yeah.
And it goes up and down in its extreme, sometimes in 5 minutes, from depression into bliss, from self.
Strange, isn't it, when it does that?
No self, and then back. Like, usually, you know, I can stay here or there for an hour, for two.
Yeah.
Sometimes in no self for 4 hours. Usually in the morning I wake up identified with the ego. Around afternoon I'm in the self.
Yeah.
Towards the nighttime, I'm totally fine in no self. But the thing is, I'm kind of not really going out in the world, because from ego, I'm manifesting something else than from self, than from no self.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of completely disoriented in, like, kind of how to, you know, how to live. Like, there is still, like, in the self, there is the seeking for going into no self. And from ego, of course, I want to get out,
Well, I mean, not you, one can't help it.
So I'm with that, and kind of like my life isn't moving anymore. I have been, like, for many, many years in silence, in solitude. I feel I need to kind of, I'm lacking to be able to anchor.
Okay. Well, what you mentioned, first of all, I really appreciate what you said and what you shared. It's a really, I think, an important part of this perspective of all this, because to some extent or another, what you're experiencing is not uncommon to many, many people. From people, it's very overt and difficult, and some people, it's much more subtle. But going between, you know, the fact that you can go between these perceptions, let's say, and states of being very quickly, that's not just like a sort of a, you know, a ladder where you just sort of climb up one rung to the next. It you can actually flash forward and backward all over the place for quite a while. In fact, that's kind of the norm as at least part of this all unfolds. I think that those parts of your experience, like you said, when you can kind of just be flashback or pulled back into sort of a more of an ego state of perception, and it's really important when that happens, as it happens for most people for quite a while, is that the cure for that, let's say, I know this is a strange way of talking about it, but the cure for that is not necessarily to just try to be in a higher state of being. That cures some of it. But often people run into these deeper kind of issues of ego. You know, the more, strangely enough, as we loosen our identification with ego, often at some point the more real existential sticking points become more prominent in our experience. And those, as I say, those are usually not effectively dealt with by just trying to go to another state. They really take a kind of compassion. You know, they really take a kind of meeting them from a real compassionate place, but a like a wise compassion, not simply compassion, not just love, but a kind of wise love, that you meet them with a kind of energy field of love and compassion and caring and patience, but you also meet them with a kind of wisdom, where that wisdom is what gains you access to what's really the sticking point. What do I really need to see here? What's this sticking point exactly about? Do you know? What is it exactly and precisely about? And what do I need to see about it? What am I, in other words, What have I not gotten? You know, when you get what you're supposed to get, when you see what you're supposed to be see about it, it'll release itself. That's how all this stuff works. So that's what I mean by a willingness to see it, not from a place of trying to get rid of it, but really from a compassionate, loving place and with great patience as well, and allowing the stuck points to really begin to open, to really reveal themselves. It's very, very important. Because only by doing that can they really eventually reveal themselves. You'll start to see what's really holding it together. And then eventually you don't get pulled back. You know, we get pulled back for very good reasons, because there's something for us to see. That's why we get pulled back.
Okay. Because when I'm in the no-self and I look at the former problem,
right,
in the ego, it's completely gone.
They're not there. No, because you're
no.
in a completely different dimension of being, completely different. The ego doesn't even register in no-self, does it?
So it looks like the solution is in being able to sustain the state of no-self, even if it's not a state. But you are saying, no, that's not the resolution. You have
yeah.
to meet
yeah.
the pain that's still hiding somewhere lower
yeah.
down.
Yeah,
that's how do I get this right?
Exactly. You got it right.
Okay.
Right, because that's what will allow that to let go, so that the falling into the no-self state will become a spontaneous and sustained thing, right? So when there's something that's unresolved in another state of our consciousness, that which is unresolved keeps pulling us out of the higher state. And certainly, as you probably know, when you go to the state of the sort of exalted, radiant love state, that clears a lot of egoic stuff away. When you touch upon the no-self, even for a moment, that also can clear away some egoic stuff. But rarely does it clear it all out. Usually there's some really fundamental things, deeply existential fundamental things, that it's almost like you don't come back at it from the state of no-self, because it's almost more from that state of a kind of a radiant, open-hearted love and compassion. And that's what kind of shines its light back on those areas. You know, it's almost like a mother coming back for a crying child or something. Do you know? That dimension of your being that doesn't leave any part of suffering behind, that it comes to liberate the suffering, actually. So see it from the eyes of, see if you can see it at moments from the eyes of love and compassion and caring, because that's an energy that really allows the ego to show itself, to really reveal what its holding point really is. Do you know? When we're just looking at it to get it over with, to get the ego to let go and get done with it, it doesn't really let go. It has to have that kind of more of a compassionate, loving presence. That has to come there to meet what's still having a hard time letting go, right? Because it, from its point of view, whatever's holding on, if you get in, this is the interesting thing about any illusion. If we get inside of an illusion, inside of it, not outside where we see, oh, it's an illusion, but inside of it, every illusion has a kind of logic to it. You see, like, oh, well, of course it's holding on, because this is how it sees. So there's a kind of logic. Of course it's grasping on because it thinks this is necessary, or because it thinks it's going to be harmed. So it's like you get inside of the illusion and you see it from its point of view, then it's a lot easier to unhook it. If you're seeing it from outside, you're not really, it's harder to unhook it because you haven't seen it from its point of view.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I just repeat what I understood.
Okay.
Yeah. So what I understand is, like, I mean, if I'm looking at difficulties in the ego
yeah.
from a compassionate state, in that moment, usually I'm not in the ego. I'm somewhere in the self. Yeah?
Okay.
So
have this. What I want you to feel into is there's a part when you're in the self and there's all that love and expansion and sense of well-being, right? And it just wants to be in that place. If you go even deeper into it, you'll find a really more selfless experience of it, which is it transcends its desire just to be in that wonderful place. And there's a love that almost moves out or back from it and comes back for the holding points of the ego. It's a truly selfless movement of love. It sacrifices its own experience of love in order to go back and really meet the part of you that's still stuck.
Yeah, I get a sense of what you're talking about.
Yeah. Because it's, you know, that's the thing about this depth of experience, because we're talking about lots of levels and depths of experience simultaneously happening, that even in this sort of wonderful, beautiful, boundless love, there are actually many gradations of boundless love that often, if we don't look very closely, we don't notice, and we just feel a kind of boundless love, and we go, oh, that's wonderful, and all of a sudden the ego drops away, and it's not a problem, and yes, this is really what I want. I'm so glad I'm not bothered by it. But there's a deeper experience of that, just a little deeper. It's kind of one of those little gradations where that love is, it's no longer oriented towards itself. It moves out in a selfless way. It moves out as an act of love to go back and to meet the suffering. In other words, it's not just wanting to stay in its own state of well-being and love and happiness and expansion, that it would actually sacrifice some of that to go back and give the ego what it needs. Can you feel that?
Yeah, what I get in the feeling of what you're saying is like self meeting the ego and kind of almost like merging into each other.
So, yeah.
Because then, then ego is kind of like completely contained in self. Somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're merging, you're not identifying with it, but you're really getting inside of it, and you really want it to reveal the nature and the reasons for its suffering, for its holding on, right? You really want to know. And I mean, know not just from an intellectual point, but your heart wants to know. Because that's how it helps. That's how it expresses itself. Okay?
In the self, there is like, I have like kind of like a really strong experience sometimes. Which I'm not really, like, I don't like all this esoteric kind of stuff,
yeah.
But sometimes I feel like almost like a master is entering my physical body, and I can mm-hmm. feel that suddenly I'm kind of like moving like them, I'm kind of acting, sometimes I even speak like them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if this is something that's in any way helpful or something I should try to let go of.
Can you define that one more time for me? When you say them, who's the them?
Well, it's kind of like it feels as if suddenly I'm kind of sensing that there is not the usual feeling of Tara anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There is like the sense of I'm feeling like, for example, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, I can
yeah.
feel his presence.
Yeah.
I can even feel it in my energy field. I can feel that I move out towards people as if I would be him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not called down. It happens
mm-hmm.
for about half an hour, sometimes more, sometimes less. And it's kind of like, I mean, like in that moment I have access to a lot of wisdom, to a lot of love.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm kind of confused. What is that? Is it something common, or is it something that is because I have made myself so empty that this is kind of happening? A little bit like some people are channeling or doing something like that.
I would say all of that. Everything you just mentioned. All of that.
Mm-hmm. I don't really know what to do with it. Yeah, it can also feel like a divine beings coming. Yeah. I can ask them questions. They give answers. So it's some esoteric kind of stuff I should...
I wouldn't say you would go away from it, but I wouldn't indulge in it either.
Okay.
I wouldn't put too much sort of energy into it.
It's so no self is something like that, dropping completely away?
Pretty much.
Or can it still be part of life?
Well, let's just find out.
Let's just find out.
I always think it's best that, you know, that we just sort of have the... I mean that not in a casual way, but in a real way of like, yeah, let's, you know, find that out, you know, to let our interest, let our curiosity, let our questioning lead the way. Do you know? I mean, even though I'm giving a lot of definition to a lot of this subject, I also fundamentally really want to encourage people to kind of live their own question out, to live that out, to find out for oneself, you know, because in the end, that's what matters, isn't it? What we find out for ourselves. Yeah.
So there is like one thing that very much like pulls me down since 2 years in the ego state again and again, and I have encountered a lot on like this meeting you were talking about, this meeting of what is it that's kind of like pulling back again and again. And I would like to ask you if you could have a look with me on that particular, like, really like hard knot. Like I have had like a very close relationship to a teacher, and then the teacher asked me to go into a practice which didn't feel right for me, and I said no to it, and he didn't stop asking me for doing it, and kind of like telling me it would be my problem that I'm suffering from his request.
Yeah.
Because I have concepts around it, and because I have concepts, I can't do it, and I'm suffering. So I felt like pushed into a sexual praxis with him, which I don't wanted to do.
Yeah.
And there is still inside of me trying to figure out, was I wrong to say no?
No, you are right.
Does he have like a black spot here?
Could. I'm always, put it this way, I'm always very suspicious when someone's trying to push someone into anything.
Yeah.
Why are they doing that?
So what is my problem here is like, did I feel pushed because of a kind of like a conditioning inside of me, a trauma, or did he really push? It's like hard for me to see, and how do I come here to... clarity.
I think it's kind of certain if you back up and you just start to look at it from, you're trusting your experience, as you said, something just told you that this isn't what you wanted to do. Started out as something very simple. There's this request made, you felt like, no, that's not what I wanted to do. That's a very simple thing. Why you felt like that, what it might have meant, what were his motivations? What was he trying to do? All of that is where everything starts to get very complicated.
Yes, right.
Right? And I think that's where we get into kind of, you know, just sort of giving our own interpretations. And I don't want to give any interpretation, because I think often what we have that's most powerful for us is the most simple. You know? Who knows why he asks what he asks? It's not really something you have to figure out. Who knows why exactly you felt the way you felt? First of all, thing you feel is there was a request made. It didn't feel right to you. It was sort of, it kept being made again and again, and that didn't feel right to you. And that's what you got to go on. And that's what I would say is trust it. Trust that. Just trust that. Too often that kind of knowing is given up because we think, well, you know, I'm not the teacher, or I'm not, you know, completely enlightened, or I'm not something, or, and, you know, before you know it, you can find yourself doing all sorts of things. You would go look back later and go, well, that really wasn't very wise. And at the moment you realize that you didn't need to be fully enlightened, you didn't need to be fully anything to have access to a very, very simple feeling or intuition or voice that just said, no, that's not the right thing for me. You know, it was just there that you can, we have access to oftentimes much more wisdom than we give ourselves credit for. But you have to be willing to sort of stand within it, you know? Just go, well, this is my experience, and at the end of the day, I'm the one that's going to live my life, and I'm the one that has to make the decisions about my life, not somebody else. And so, you know,
yeah,
you just do it.
The fear for me is like now how to relate to my teacher, because there is a voice that says I have to show him something here, or don't, why not?
That I couldn't tell you. I can't tell you how. All I can tell you is if, you know, there's some sort of pushing going on, some sort of, if you're experiencing a kind of pressure or whatever, especially if it has anything remotely to do with any kind of sexuality practice, I would have my to tell you the truth, my alarm bells would be going off very loudly. Very loudly.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, I would trust that. And I would trust that all the way. I really, really would trust that. I think you're picking up on something. The only question is, are you just going to act on it? You know? I mean, if you're going to have someone for your teacher, you really got to have someone that you trust. And trust is not blind. Trust doesn't mean you just give your trust and then you just follow it. You follow whatever they say forever. Trust means that the person has to remain trustworthy in your eyes over and over and over and over and over. Like, it's like trust isn't something that's just granted once and then that's it. It's they have to remain trustworthy for you over and over and over and over and over. Otherwise, you know, what are we doing? What are we doing? And why aren't we listening to ourselves? But, you know, listen to yourself first and act on it and then wonder why. Because you can spend so much time wondering why that you're not actually acting on what your intuition is telling you. You know, really just follow it through. Yeah, it might, who knows where it will lead, but, you know, I would really trust it. I would really trust it. Okay? I have a couple other people who are waiting very patiently.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed talking with you. It was just lovely.
Yeah, thank you, Adya.
Yeah, I wish you all the best. Okay? Yeah. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Okay. People have been holding on for quite a while. I'll try to come through them. Let's see. Silas. Is that how to say the name?
Silas.
Thank you. Pardon me.
Good evening.
Hi. Hi. Welcome.
Thank you. Why don't we listen to ourselves? There's a good question.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think a lot of times, I think it's actually something very simple. I think most, vast majority of human beings, you know, we get sort of, we're taught not to, you know? We're just taught not to. And of course, you know, I mean, we know, you know, I know, everybody listening to this knows that, you know, we're all prone to our own self-delusion. That's always a possibility too. But sometimes, especially in people in spirituality, people are so acutely aware that they can be prone to their own self-delusion because, if anything, you know, spirituality will show us the many moments when we have been self-deluded. But we can almost make you inoperable. You know, it makes you incapable of really listening to that own, your own intuitive voice of wisdom, because you go, well, I could be wrong. Well, you could be wrong, but you could be right. That's right.
Yeah, which really delves into the inquiry of that capacity, when we gain that capacity.
Yeah.
On so many levels to change, to see, to listen.
Yeah. And, you know, like I said, I don't understand all the different ways and all the different teaching styles. I wouldn't be so presumptuous to say that I do understand them. I only really understand what I underwent with my teacher and the way I do it, you know. And to me, I think it's very, very important that people begin to hone in on what they can trust within themselves immediately. It's not like something you do at the end of the whole spiritual path. It's something that you should do from day one. And I think that's a very important part of a teachings and a teacher's role, is to help people to find that, not to become a surrogate for your own wisdom, you know, to always stand in for it and always say, well, I know more than you do, but to help people to distinguish. Yes, we can all delude ourselves, but we also can be very wise at times, and we should, you know, it seems like our inquiry should be a process of helping us to see the difference between the two.
You spoke of that to me a long time ago in a discourse around finding that voice that you knew wasn't the mind.
Yeah.
And just knowing the difference.
Yeah.
Was a big step. Mm-hmm. Because then it gave you a common ground, a bearing.
Yeah.
A bearing in the darkness.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very, very, very important, you know. Oof. It's very important because, again, the other thing about it all is, you know, even when you engage in, let's say, a particular teaching, you have to even engage in that teaching in your own unique way. You know, you can throw 1,000 people, let's say, at a, they go to a Buddhist monastery and everything's done sort of, say, cookie cutter, and it's all exactly the same way. Well, for 50 of those, it might work out that that's exactly what they needed. The other 950, it's not that they needed something different, but they needed their own sort of unique way of moving through it. And if that's allowed, great. If it's not allowed, then you have 950 people that are like round pegs trying to stuff themselves into a square hole.
Right. What you needed was to realize that you didn't need that and to move on.
Yeah. to move on, or like I said, or to have, you could be in a monastery, you can be with a teacher that understands that and goes, well, yeah, we can't, you know, we can't change the monastery to suit you, but we can certainly
accommodate you the way in which you see.
Accommodate your own unfolding in a way that really helps you rather than distances you.
Right, the way a garden accommodates all the flowers that grow in it.
Exactly. Right, exactly.
Okay, yeah. Back to no experience.
Okay.
My question refers to the way in which you refer to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that you are living in an experience of no experience, no self.
Yeah, I've never been inclined, let's say, not that it's wrong to be, but I've never been inclined to alter my language, remove my personal pronouns, because number one, it just makes one stand out, and it just sounds too damn odd to my ear, and it just seemed like way too much work. So some people they do that and it resonates, but it doesn't work that way here.
Okay, so like in the beginning of the first evening of class, you said, I told myself that I would be very honest with everybody.
Yeah.
And I guess maybe that becomes a figure of speech in the
it
sense
does.
Of the way you're expressing it.
It absolutely. It's a figure of speech. I mean, I could have said, you know, the thought arose that I'd just be as honest. What I mean by honest is I'm always feel like I'm honest with people, but I meant honest in a sense of straightforward, not sugarcoating it,
right.
Not making something that's maybe difficult to hear easier to hear.
Right.
You know, but it was just, you know, it was just, It was just a thought that arose.
I guess what triggered tonight was, in the experience of no self,
yeah,
you know, go to the end of it all. Go to the end of this experience where no self exists. You know, there's just like, there you are.
Yeah.
And there you are. And so there's this sense of, like, when you speak of, like, we, you know, this is what we will experience, or this is what it will be like, there still seems like there's this really interesting way in which, you know, the infinite has decided to experience itself through you.
Yeah.
Personally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I have moments,
sure,
of no self.
Yeah.
And there I am.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not there. Like, the ego isn't there.
Yeah.
You know, the witness isn't there.
Yeah.
It's literally pure life.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like.
Right. And there's still, life. And even in that, right?
Right.
Even in that, there's a particular guy sitting there, standing there, doing whatever he's doing, you know, and there's that part of relative experience also. Right?
So it's so almost laughable, like it's,
yes,
really interesting. It's sort of, I don't know, it makes all so much of the searching evaporate for me.
Yes, that's the whole point.
Because it's like, there you are.
There you are. Yeah.
There you are.
Yeah.
And there's life. It's laughable listening to all of this because, you know, so many points through it. I think, who the hell would want any of this?
Yeah.
You know?
Of course.
You know, nobody would want this.
Right.
You know, the ego doesn't want it.
No.
And then you're like,
no,
oh, I'm about to enter into the state of witness and all this sort of stuff. And then you're like, no self. And you're like, oh, I don't want that either. Is no self an abiding, non-abiding experience?
Well, it depends. It depends on how it occurs for different people.
Right.
I mean, obviously, it's, one can pop into a state, a really profound state of no self, we could say. And they may, you can be there for a minute, a day, a week, a month, who knows, a second. And then one can pop right back into ego state.
Right.
So that's where I've kind of have tried to say, even though I know the whole presentation of this, you know, it keeps making it appear a certain way, but again, there's this sort of paradox, which is sort of, no self is always the fundamental reality, right? It's the fundamental reality of what we are, which even that sentence itself sounds ridiculous, but nonetheless, it is the fundamental reality. It's not like it comes into being at some point in time. It's just recognized.
It's recognized. Right.
Right. It's recognized, and it can be unrecognized and recognized and unrecognized at a moment. And so it's like you can go from A to Z at any instant because A and Z are actually in the same place. But metaphorically, let's say, you can go from A to Z at any instant and
right,
back, and then somewhere in between. And
right,
so even though there can be almost sort of a haphazard moving around to these different perspectives, if you look back at the whole trajectory of, or you take, like I do, you know, 10,000 people and you look at the trajectory and you can say, yeah, people are moving around in these very different dimensions of being or perspectives, whatever you want to call them. But also, for the vast majority of them, there's also this almost predictable unfolding within that sort of chaos back and forth. That also, it also unfolds in this sort of bigger trajectory that's almost, for most people, there's always exceptions, is almost quite predictable. You know, the different phases they go through and all, even though they can just jump over 10 phases at any
right,
instant.
Similarly to becoming an adult from a
yeah,
child.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, you can have your four-year-old can all of a sudden say something that sounds like an 80-year-old sage.
Right. Right.
With huge life experience, and you wonder, where did that come from?
And then fall to the ground and have a temper tantrum.
Exactly, right. Right, and of course, you know, adults can turn into, you know, like a four-year-old having a tantrum right after they gave some, you know, great presentation to the board of the corporation, you know.
Right.
So this moving around is this pliability of experience and perception is really quite dynamic and amazing. And just like growing up, we may fast forward only to go back, but also there is this trajectory of infancy to childhood to adolescence to adulthood and beyond, you know, even though we can bounce back all over the place for a while.
There is a gradual growth.
That's
sort of semi-predictable, the same way we will get old.
It's semi-predictable. Yeah, there are always those exceptions, you know.
Right, of course. There's virtuosos.
That's right.
There's kids that are geniuses. There's
Who knows? They just had, you know, just damn good luck, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there are those cases, even in modern times, where people have gone from literally completely rageful, suicidal, completely and absolutely dysfunctional people that have popped right into the ultimate reality and basically stayed there. It happens.
Of course.
Is that the norm?
No,
that's the less than 1% of 1%.
And it's a good thing because the beginning of that experience is very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So let's thank God most of us don't have to go through that.
Right. Oh, that's right.
Right.
That's right. Yeah. To have to go under that kind of suffering to blast yourself that fast and completely is a hell of a lot of suffering.
It's a lot of suffering.
Most people will have the same amount of suffering and they'll just tailspin with it.
Right.
They won't pop in.
They won't pop out.
No.
We see that all the time and they hit ground zero.
That's right.
Yeah.
Happens all the time.
Yeah, it's funny because I can feel the whole process in motion many times for myself, moving in and out, but I feel the undercurrent of that flow happening like you know, I didn't pop a hole in the tire. I smashed a hole in it. You know, like it's, you know, and for tonight was one of the first times I actually felt a lot of fear. Like, oh my God, there's a semi point of no return.
Yeah.
Like I've kind of passed the point of no return.
Yeah.
It's just moving in that direction.
Right.
And I wanted to illustrate a discourse that's dear to me on abiding awakening because it flips the question around, and you basically talk about how ultimate reality is all there is.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, how do we keep on enlightening ourselves?
Yep.
And it sounds the same when you talk about no self, like no self is all there really is. That ultimate reality is all that exists.
Mm-hmm.
How are we staying out of it? And at the same time, because I want to talk about this experientially, I see it all happening simultaneously as well. Like I can see the no self or the ultimate reality is consistently there.
Mm-hmm.
There's all these layers that are there. It's not a linear movement like if I do this, that. Like it's all accessible at any given moment depending on...
Yes.
You know, almost not even what I, but that which chooses to be aware of.
Right.
And you sort of start to feel out of control of the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's disorienting, and sometimes it's like, you know, you realize you're fighting the tide.
Yeah.
And it's so much easier in the surrender to get into the flow of it.
Yeah.
Because that state you're speaking of doesn't seem to be in conflict with the dream state.
Not at all.
It is the dream state.
Yeah, not at
as
all.
Well. I mean,
that's right.
It's
the whole thing. Yeah.
You know, like if it's either
the whole thing.
All of it or it's not.
That's right.
There's no in between that.
That's right.
Like that's a distinction we all have to make and come to.
Yeah.
A point of entry in some ways.
Yeah.
It's all of it or it's not. It's not.
That's right.
And there just doesn't seem to be. From that perspective, there's just no conflict with any of it.
Yeah.
It's dreaming.
There really isn't.
Then it's dreaming, and then it's awake, and then it's having this conversation, and then it's putting kids to bed, and you know.
Yeah. Well, if anything, I mean, I have one more caller that's been waiting. I want to get to, but what you really illustrated, it's an important part of all this, is that, you know, no matter what we say, I say, you say, anybody else says, and how we define something, that the closer we get to the real fundamental inclusive reality is, it all becomes extraordinarily paradoxical, and no statements can just stand on their own, because every statement is in its own sense dualistic, and it just in experience, which is why I was glad that you were speaking, in experience, the deeper we go, the more paradoxical, at least to the mind, that experience becomes. It becomes something that's all-inclusive at the end of the day has to be almost absolutely paradoxical. Otherwise, it's not absolutely all-inclusive. But of course, it's only paradoxical to the mind. In actual experience, there's no paradox at all. It's just everything just is the way it is. Yeah. Well, my friend, I really enjoy talking to you.
Yeah, thanks, Audra. I just want to tell you something funny. That my kids, we think you're so cool. My kids don't. You know? And that's just an expression of, you know, being in the state, you know?
That's right, yeah.
You know? We're like, oh, Audra's on tonight. They're like, oh, not Audra.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah. Tell your kids I understand their feeling more than their parents.
Hilarious.
I would have the same feeling if I was home.
Yeah,
I'd be like, oh, not Audra again, really, come on.
Yeah, really. I think that our kids will grow up not liking spirituality the same way a lot of people don't like religion. You know, stole their parents from them.
The nice thing is it doesn't really matter. They're going to live it out anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
It's totally cool.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah, good, Audra.
Thanks for calling.
Blessings, man. Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, let's go to Colleen. Thank you for waiting so long, Colleen. I appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. Thanks, Audra.
Yeah.
My question is pretty quick. Tonight you talked about wanting the truth for the sake of truth, no matter what it is.
Yeah.
And having an unrestricted desire for reality on its own terms.
Which is, by the way, as a qualification, that's usually something we grow into also. You know, rarely does it start out that way, but sometimes.
So that's really my question, is how in my practice and in my daily life can I open to that and grow into that?
Well, just the first thing is feel the presence of it. Feel the presence of it. Feel that there is, I mean, let's put it this way. So it's very common that one has different agendas, right? I would actually like to feel better. I would actually like to feel unity because that's really wonderful and that's lovely and I want to feel more of that. And there can be all these, you know, these wants. And if we don't make any of those wants wrong, right, or something that shouldn't be, then they're just there. They just are what they are. You know, human beings by their nature are inclined towards feeling better than worse, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's just there. So you don't make a big deal about that. Then you go, okay, is there, without trying to make it or produce it or even find it, but is there in my experience right now, is there also that which just wants truth? You could call it God, you could call it reality, whatever. Is there that within me right now that just wants the truth for its own sake, whether it feels good or doesn't or however it ends up to be, you know, that place inside yourself that just goes, I just have to know whether I like it. I just have to know. And it may be a very quiet place within you. But I think if you just said, is there that place within me that just wants it for its own sake? It's almost like you're eliciting just by asking the question, do you know, rather than trying to find it or be like that or have that desire or whatever, that you just kind of elicit it like, is it there? Is it part of my experience right now? even if I have competing desires. It doesn't mean it's not there.
Okay.
See what I mean?
I'm taking notes.
Yeah. Just feel it. The sense here is you sense it. It's something you kind of feel into rather than you try to convince yourself of. That's why I'm presenting it as a question, because I don't want to be so presumptuous that I know what's in your experience. But we're looking at it together, do you know? We're just asking the question, is there that sort of unrestricted desire, yearning, however you'd put it, for the truth, for reality, for its own sake? Is there that, the sense of that, the intuition of that in my experience?
Okay.
Right now. And then you just start to get, you might start as just kind of a glimmer, like, oh yeah, there seems to be something in there that feels kind of like that. Do you know? Mm-hmm. Oh, there is something in there that's kind of like that. You know, it just wants it for its own sake, whatever that ends up to be. And you just allow yourself to feel that a bit. You don't have to make it anything that it's not, because we travel along the trajectory of our desires, right? It's just we let go of certain desires when they no longer work. You know, someone can go like, well, I just want everybody in the world to love me. And then eventually they realize, you know, that just isn't going to work out. That's not a good thing to hitch my happiness onto. So you eventually let go of that desire and you go to something else. And really, it's kind of, I know, you know, this seems like a sort of a linear thing, but it's almost like by following any desire you have to the end point, at any point along the way, you realize it just leads you to the higher one, do you know? And then before you know it, you know, I just want to stop suffering, or I want to feel unified, or I want to feel whatever I want to. And if you follow those along, eventually you can find in yourself, I just really want to know. I want to know what life is for life's sake. I want to know what God is, no matter what. Not for a reason, not for a payoff. I just really, because that ultimate, I guess you could say ultimate desire or yearning, that's innate within us. It's not like we have to create it or fake it or pretend it. It's there. It may not be on the surface of one's consciousness, but that's okay. It is actually, it's there. It's a part of every being. It's part of the imprint of the infinite, you know?
It seems hard sometimes to recognize it for what it is.
Yeah.
It gets so confused with, you know, just basically being taught that it's this, that, or the other thing.
Right.
That it's all about. So, okay, I think I've got the guidance that I was looking for. And
okay.
Thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Good
okay. Good night. Great. Well, I know we've gone late. So, for those of you who hung in there with me and with us, I thank you, and enjoyed our time together. Hold all of this lightly. Pay attention to your own experience. Find that within yourself that you can trust. That small, intuitive voice of wisdom. Simple voice. And don't forget the greatest teaching of all, the greatest supplementary teaching to all of this, is stillness. To be still, to be quiet, is such a powerful way in which we unfold into the fullness that we are. So don't forget the quietness. Nice to be with you. Namaste.